For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning and hello to this auspicious assembly, both here in the room and online. And however many other countless bodhisattvas are present with us. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, and online. Okay, great. So we're commemorating today Buddha's parinirvana, which is Buddha's passing into final nirvana, or, you know, as we think of it, passing away. I don't know if we're celebrating it or if we're just remembering it, but we are here gathering to offer our attention and care to it, for sure. So I want to talk a little bit about historical Shakyamuni Buddha, and we'll talk about some maybe wider implications. I think the last time we checked in about historical Shakyamuni Buddha was at Rohatsu, when we were commemorating Buddha's awakening at what we believe to be about age 35. And I won't go into all of that, but we know that Shakyamuni Buddha lived to somewhere around 80 years old. And so he spent maybe the next 40 to 45 years after his awakening teaching the Dharma and giving talks. And he amassed, you know, quite a number of followers and people who also were awake or awakened from listening to Buddha's teaching or working with Buddha's teaching. And around 80 years old, Buddha began to recognize that he was old and that his body was wearing out. And this was actually in accord with one of his teachings, which is that all conditioned phenomena arise and pass away. And so I think he was aware, and I don't think he was particularly upset by this. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would really have upset Shakyamuni Buddha. But recognizing that I think that he was about to pass away, he did some talking with Sangha about, you know, how to function as a Sangha. He encouraged his Sangha to uphold 7 principles that would enable them to prosper as a Sangha. And those 7 principles were to hold regular and frequent assemblies, to meet in harmony, to not change the rules of training or to follow the rules of training, which at that time, at that historical time, I think would have been the Vinaya. But for us, I think we can think of as the precepts, since we don't observe the Vinaya, but we do observe our 16 Bodhisattva precepts. He also said, you know, to honor superiors who were ordained before them. Do not fall prey to worldly desires. This was, I think, key to maintaining, a mind free from excesses such as greed, for instance. To meet in forest hermitages, I think is what he literally said, but what I think he meant was to meet away from society, apart from worldly concerns, and encouraged his followers to preserve their personal mindfulness, that this was of utmost importance to them. And so that was, you know, sort of the 7 admonitions that Buddha talked about in his final year. And at some point, he really recognized that he was becoming frequently ill and too ill and weak and tired to continue traveling. He kind of came to rest in Kushinagara and took his last meal, which was an offering from a blacksmith named Kunda, and then became violently ill, although he stated that it was not because of this meal. and that Kunda was really to be revered as someone who, you know, offered sustenance to Buddha. But he then lay down in a grove of trees in Kushinagara between two sala trees in the pose that we can see, the reclining pose on his side that we can see on our altar today. He announced that he would soon be passing into nirvana and asked if any disciples had any doubts about the teaching. I think he asked this maybe three times, and no one had any questions. And so he then spoke his final words and passed away into nirvana. What were his final words? I don't know. I wasn't there. I have seen, you know, multiple different translations of Buddha's final words along two basic lines. And one would be, and these were, the Buddha spoke in and taught in Pali, which was the language of Nepal. And so the one source says that Buddha said, apamadena sampadeta, which means, you know, strive unceasingly, be diligent. Someone has translated this as care, and I really like that. Bring care to your activities. I think you can, and I think all of those kind of are within accord with one another. Now, there's another account that says that Buddha said, apdipo bhava, which is be your own lamp, or something along those lines. So how can we understand this? The one translation of apdipo bhava has been translated as, you know, be a lamp unto yourself, be a refuge unto yourself, take no external refuge other than use yourself, you know, as your guide. And that might be what he said, but he did also just say that we should, that his followers should follow the teachings, you know? So how do those two things fall together? How do we take no external refuge, but then also, you know, take refuge in Buddha? Our first refuge is I take refuge in Buddha. We also take refuge in Dharma. We take refuge in Sangha. And so, how do we understand that? And how do we also be true to ourselves, maybe, or take, you know, be a light unto ourselves without setting up standards of our own, which we know from our founder in Japan, Heihei Dogen, is important. It's important not to set up standards of our own, and we can very, very, very easily fall into self-delusion about what is right. Because it's hard to refrain from confusing what is right for me with what is right for everyone. You know, what is right for the world. When things happen that don't feel right for me, it can feel like it's wrong for everyone. But that's not necessarily true. So another translation of this might be, make of yourself a lamp. I've heard people say that these were Buddha's last, you know, that was a translation of Buddha's last words as well. Make of yourself a lamp. And I like this one. It seems to carry with it more of the spirit of the first statement of strive unceasingly or care. You know, when we have a lamp, we can see more clearly. And when we are a lamp, we can help ourselves and others to see more clearly. But again, you know, I think this falls into that question of how can we know if we are a lamp or if we are just carrying ourselves forward, you know, carrying forward our own views or perspectives and thereby perpetuating delusion. So how do we know when we are a lamp? And I think there is really no easy answer for this. But we do have the teachings to guide us, and we have teachers and our comrades within our Sangha to help us to stay open and accountable. And I think that this is why it's, we talk about awakening as being, you know, between a Buddha and a Buddha, that there's no Buddha in a vacuum. We need each other to stay on track. And when I say each other, I mean, I think everybody, you know, people that we dislike, people who have views that are different maybe from our own. We really need everyone to help us stay on track. And I think that that's my personal truth for what is important right now, when there is so very much divisiveness in our world. So I want to talk a little bit about the implications of, you know, the idea of being a lamp unto yourself, maybe, you know, be true to yourself, or make of yourself a lamp for everyone, you know. And I think it starts with, and I don't have any answers for these questions, okay? So these are questions that we all get to grapple with together. But, you know, how do we respond to the suffering around us? Because it is hard to go very far in your daily life without recognizing that there is quite a lot of suffering in the world. And we have, you know, one of our ancient teachers, Yunmen, who was asked, you know, what is the teaching of the Buddhas and the ancestors? And Yunmen replied, an appropriate response, which I think is a very, very profound. You know, how do we find an appropriate response? And for that answer, I think we can each turn to our own practice. You know, we need to remain present and aware and caring and concerned and humble, you know, and I think that practice can help us to do that. We may at times need to turn away from the suffering of the world if it becomes too much, you know, if we need to take care of ourselves. But then I think it's important to return, to not get so far removed from our awareness of suffering that we fall into delusion. And we can also use, you know, our own suffering as a guide. If we are suffering in some way, perhaps others are. Maybe not all others. Maybe others are suffering in their own ways. But I think it's important to just have that awareness that there is pain in our lives and pain in the world outside of our lives, and just to bear witness to that and help each other in our efforts to bear witness to that. I think it's important to, you know, remain realistic with our expectations for ourselves and our expectations for others. And then to remember also that hearing the cries of the world is itself bodhisattva activity. We have, I think at times, you know, chanted the universal gateway of Kanzaion Bodhisattva, which is from the Lotus Sutra, which I'll get into in a minute, where we talk about the cry regarder, that there's power in being able to hear the cries of the world and allow them to, you know, allow them to touch us, allow them to penetrate our own defenses and just to respond with care, whatever that cry might be. So we can, you know, try to respond with compassion to all of the cries that we hear. And I think that this starts with, you know, accepting ourselves, accepting the person who's sitting here whose own ankle is hurting or whose feet are falling asleep or who is, tired or distracted, and having some compassion for yourself, which can then hopefully extend to others. I want to read a poem on this topic by Mary Oliver. I think David is going to share it online, but why, look here. I happen to have copies. I have about a dozen copies. So if you could take one, and if there are people who are sitting together, if you could share together, that would be really, really, really helpful, because I think there are more than a dozen people in the room. Yeah, a baker's dozen of people in the room. But I will read it out loud while it's coming around. So the poem is entitled "The Buddha's Last Instruction" by Mary Oliver. "Make of yourself a light," said the Buddha before he died. "I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two sala trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs, disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly, I'm not needed, yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd." So I really like this poem, and I don't have the definitive view on it, but I appreciate that it ends with Buddha looking, Buddha bearing witness to the, maybe fear, apprehension, confusion. What are we going to do now? And just bearing witness to that. And I think that is something that we ourselves can do. I also want to talk for a moment about this is what I've been talking about is kind of the historical view of Buddha, perhaps the Theravadan view of Buddha to a certain extent. But there is also a teaching from the Lotus Sutra, it's a chapter called The Inconceivable Lifespan of Buddha, and it's chapter 16, and in this chapter, Buddha tells us that he actually awakened countless kalpas ago, and only appears to have awakened recently as skillful means to teach others. To teach others what? To teach others how to awaken. Buddha says that he only appears to have been born and passed away so that beings will not become complacent, but will become faithful, honest, and upright. So that, I think what he's saying is so that beings will use Buddha's life and awakening and the whole story as an example. As being a light for us to awaken in our lives. But it also reminds us that his Pure Land is not destroyed, even though it appears that way to the ordinary observer. And doesn't it appear that this is not the Pure Land of Buddha? I mean, there's a lot of suffering here. But what if it was? I just like to think to myself, what if this is the Pure Land of Buddha? And it appears that way because, from my perspective, things are not going the way I want them to, or I think they should. And I think that's much more profoundly true for many people beyond myself. But there's something here. So I leave us maybe with, well, there was something I was going to say. Yeah, that's maybe all I want to say about that. And I know we want to leave time for some conversation or questions or thoughts. But I will close by just, you know, saying, is there a way that we can use this teaching as encouragement when surrounded by a suffering world? Is there a way that we can have faith that we can awaken, have faith that we can bring something positive to the world, have faith that perhaps this could actually still be Buddhist Pure Land, or we can bring forth Buddhist Pure Land? The last thing I want to say is, I think that we all know the phrase, "I take refuge in Buddha." And we sometimes forget, although you've probably heard it before, Buddha actually takes refuge in us. If no one is inspired by, and no one practices, and no one brings Buddha's teaching to life in their life, then Buddha is really dead. Buddhism is a dead religion. The Buddha is dead if no one keeps him alive. But so Buddha really needs us to bring awakening and be a lamp within the world. To, you know, as well as we can. We're all human beings, we're all imperfect, and there's no way that we can break out of our limited imperfect views. But we can still work together to bring forth Buddha. And I really, really appreciate everyone's effort to do just that today. So thank you. We're open for anything. Simone is going to kick us off. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, Rishi. This resonates profoundly with everyday life for me. I wonder if you have in mind any everyday examples of what perhaps to you or you observed pulls us away from caring to our immediate surroundings and our loved ones around us, or, you know, local realities.
What pulls us away from caring for?
Yeah, what distracts us from that, and perhaps some ways that you found or you observed that are more effective and not that practiced. To just stand and care to that. Just, you know, wondering if there is something to that.
Well,
sorry for the very direct question.
No,
I was reasoning about it.
That's okay. I think it might be a little bit different for everyone. You know, I think that what prevents me from doing that sometimes is just my own, you know, kind of self-centered wishes. You know, I even with the people I hold most dear, I don't always think about, you know, what's in their best interest? How can I best take care of them? Sometimes I can get caught up in thinking about, like, how are they not taking care of me? And so that might pull me out of that place. Do you have any examples? Or maybe anybody else have you look like you are resonating with this question.
Yeah. I mean, and what you just said, that anger at people not taking care of you. I resonate with that. I resonate with, and anger, I think, I know, you know, Tygen has said, I mean, sometimes anger is valuable. I'm not, you know, negating that, but you know, it can also pull you out when you're maybe misdirecting, you know, maybe directing it too narrowly. Yeah, I was just thinking about, like anger at hypocritical virtue signaling.
Okay.
I think I sort of have some of that these days. But anyway, I was wondering about the alternation, or what seems like kind of the alternation between, you know, going out into the world and then the forest refuge, and you know, the tension that we have is wanting to be engaged Buddhists and that stuff.
Yeah, and I think that kind of falls into the other thing that I think sometimes pulls me away from caring for others, which is that as a finite, limited being, I can only do so many things at one time. And when I make a choice to engage with something, it pulls me away from other things. And I can't be present for all of the things that I feel are important, or the beings that I want to help. So there is that practical nature as well, that we have to, you know, get up and go to work or do the dishes or whatever it is that we do, and can't always pay the kind of attention that we would like to a situation that needs our care. And sometimes we're not, we really just for that reason are not even aware of situations that or people who might need our care. Does that?
I think I have enough to work with that.
Okay. Well, but so accepting that that's the truth. You asked for, you know, suggestions on how we can do it better. Accepting that that's the truth, that we maybe want to bring, knowing that we maybe want to bring care to others, and forgiving ourselves for the times when we fall short with that, as part of allowing ourselves to still stay in touch with that wish to bring care. Other thoughts? Questions?
Thank you. There was a part that resonated for me, which was the remark you made about this not being the Pure Land, and oh my gosh, I don't know. And it made me think of something where, you know, as we practice and as we practice to sit with suffering and find joy or contentment or something in the midst of sitting with personal suffering and the suffering of the world and all beings, is that not the Pure Land? Like, is that, like, I don't know, like, I think of, like, the Pure Land as, like, you know, the Christian idea of heaven or something, where, like, everything's, you know, good and rosy, and it's like, that's boring.
Well, yeah.
And not that I want suffering, but, like, it feels like if we are working towards finding a contentment or a joy in the midst of everything that happens around us,
mm-hmm.
that's a pretty great feeling for me.
Is anything, you know, permanent and unceasing,
yeah,
and unchanging? And, you know, can we catch glimpses of that Pure Land? I walked in here this morning very early to get set up for our Sishin today, and I caught, even kind of below my conscious level of perception, the fragrance of, you know, kind of old incense that's kind of permeated our space. And it reminded me, like, on a very subliminal level, of the many wonderful times I've had and experienced in Zen centers. And even though I've been kind of stressed out lately, it just like brought me back to, like, oh yes, so, you know, wonderful. I, this is, and uh,
And that's what I would want to bring to everyone. That's what I hope I can bring to, you know, everyone who is here today or hearing this talk. And I think that what you just said maybe kind of think of that experience.
Yeah.
That's oh wow, this is the pure land of Buddha. And it's kind of like what Suzuki Roshi was once quoted to be saying, you know, you're all perfect just as you are, and you all could use a little improvement. So maybe that's us. I think I saw that David Weiner had your hand up. I don't know if that's still true or if the moment has passed.
No, it's okay. Kind of. Two things. Interesting, because of my studies of, you know.
Can you hold on 1 second? Is it possible to turn it up? I can barely hear David, even.
That's what I was groping to see. David, is the low-tech way of you speaking up possible too?
Sure. I'll talk louder. That's better.
That sounds good. Thanks.
No, I'm reminded of my studies at Loyola, and a couple of things come up for me. One thing is about the lamp when you're talking. It shows just how universal this is, because there's in the Gospels, there's a line in Luke where he talks about when one has a lamp, one doesn't put a basket over it, but lets the light shine for the benefit of others. And if our eyes are healthy, if we see the world as, you know, as beautiful, then our body is filled with light. And if our eyes are unhealthy, in other words, if we look at negativity everywhere, then our bodies are filled with darkness. So I would say that's one thing. I'm really fascinated about that line, be a lamp unto yourself. But it's also, if you're a lamp unto yourself, automatically you are a lamp to others. In a sense, it's just part of the nature of doing that. And as far as Simone talking before, I can't remember part of the line from Ben Iver's prayer of serenity. You know, may I have the courage to change the things I can, and the acceptance of not being able to, and to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. And that we can't change everything. I'm not going to change some starving child in Africa right now, here in this moment. I can't do that. But there are things that I can do. And what is it that I can do? And those are the things that we have to strive for.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you, David. And hopefully to do them with compassion and happiness and joy, that our actions will then bring joy.
Yeah.
Even if you are really taken by the image of the lamp, practice with that. You know, practice with that and let yourself enjoy that image. Let yourself enjoy the way the light maybe permeates through your practice and your life. If you feel inspired by that light, I don't think it can help but find some kind of positive, wholesome outlet in the world. I think we might have time for one more. And Eve, since you spoke already, I see Wade's hand is up.
Okay.
You want to? Well. We'll wrap up with your haiku, okay? All right, thank you.
Be a light unto yourself is also, for me at least, turning around the light kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, you're right, not setting up standards of your own, but using your own mind to illuminate your own mind. Mm-hmm. And really trying to see all of it, investigating thoroughly the whole thing.
We don't have any other technology other than our own light to do that with, right? We've got the low-tech, as David put it, technology of turning our own light around, as our ancestor Shichan put it. And so we do that.
And the more thoroughly you do that, the safer you are from setting up standards of your own.
Yeah. And as well, talking together, you know, as we talk together, we can hopefully also help each other not to set up standards of our own. But all of this is low tech. It is so low tech that it could be practiced 2,500 years ago with the technology that they had at the time, and that we often have forgotten, you know, in our urge to, you know, bring modern technology to bear. But we also can use modern technology in the service of engaging in those low-tech, very powerful practices. So Eve, would you close us out with a haiku?
Scent of old incense, fragrance permeating all, grateful for sangha.
Beautiful. I think you just made that up on the spot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because I like what you said.
I really, really like that. Thank you to everyone and to our online sangha. We will be bidding you farewell shortly, but thank you for joining us. Thanks to the in-person sangha who are joining us just for the Zazen and Dharma talk this morning, and thanks to our folks who are joining us for the half day sitting. I forget the order of ceremonies. Do we stop recording?
We chant and then stop recording and then have announcements.
Okay. So we'll chant our theme song, which is on the small card that you have. I think the four bodhisattva vows, which we chant three times.
On page 36, we chant book 2.
Beings are endless, we vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it.